You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello there, I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and this is another one of the live recordings that I made up at the Edinburgh Festival this August. This is Mr. Fred McCauley.
You were talking earlier on about last night's gig.
Yes.
Tell us what you told me about last night.
Okay. This last night's gig was the first of a run of 22 that I'm doing here. And unlike a lot of comedians, I don't have a great opportunity to do preview shows. Mm. So I did it twice in Falkirk about a fortnight ago. And then the first night, it wasn't great, right? The audience laughed at the right bits, but some of the material I wasn't happy about, and nor was one of the people who chose to email me through my website just to tell me how disappointed they were in me.
Oh, and that's said, like an email heckle.
It was. And they'd said, look, we've seen you before, loved your stuff, couldn't wait to see this year's show. Frankly, Fred, we think you're better than that. I'm very disappointed, and I took the trouble to write back to say sorry, but you've only got to see it once. I have to do it every night for 3 weeks. Imagine how disappointed I am. So no, I took it on board, and you know what it's like when you're working up a show. So the next night in Falkirk, it was 50% different, and I was a lot happier with it. So that was the show that I did last night, but on first night in Edinburgh. I've got to say, I was kind of all over the place. I've had a very busy week doing other things that I might tell you about. So last night, there was a lot of consulting of notes. And okay. For somebody that's been a professional comedian all these years, I frankly think that sucks.
Okay. But oh, that's, well, okay. So that's quite a good kind of announcement to have made, you know, that does suck, and you're actually taking that on yourself rather than going, they were rubbish. They didn't like it when I read my offer.
I've never, ever blamed an audience.
Okay. That's interesting. So, in terms of last night's show, what do you plan to do about it between now and tonight's show?
I will rejig the set list so that I know just what order things are going to come in. I had a vague idea of where I wanted to put things last night. I quarter up my hour, mm-hmm. Okay? I would have a sheet of paper with four quarters, so I know what the trigger point is for each quarter hour. And then within that quarter hour, I've got other little segments, and it didn't flow last night. I didn't hit my quarter trigger point, so I will jiggle things around.
Okay. So you were saying before as well that you think the audience largely forgave you. You felt like you got away with it.
They were lovely. No, they were really very lovely audience, and I enjoyed playing with an audience. I loved engaging in chat with them, and they were up for a bit of that last night. And of course, while I was on stage, I had to encourage people to put their phones or their iPads on so that I could find out if Andy Murray had won his way through to the final the Olympic tennis. So that was exciting for us.
Very nice. Yeah. So, but I think that's something that you engender in your audiences, is a real community feel. I mean, I mentioned earlier on the fact that you twinkle, but I think that's true to say.
I've not been aware of the twinkling.
Oh, God, look, he's twinkling now, isn't he?
So already this morning, I've bobbed and twinkled.
Yeah. But I think that's one of your stronger suits, would you say, as a performer, that you engender a certain relationship with an audience. You're not a confrontational comedian.
No,
you're not sort of trying to change people's minds or transmit important ideas. How do you see yourself?
I feel belittled.
I'm sorry. But you see what I mean? Like, I don't think I am either, but I think there's something.
No, you're absolutely right. I'm not political, although there's a fair bit of politics in it, because I think for once in Scotland we are kind of entering a phase where politics is going to be more important to us as Scots than anywhere else in the UK, including Northern Ireland, which I've had their fair share of things to talk about in the last 30, 40 years. And no, I'm not even changed people's mind. First and foremost, it's been about comedy, it's been about laughter, and it's about just being funny.
Sure.
And I've always been aware that other people take a different direction. People will write very personal shows. Me, it's about coming here with new material, new funny material, and just making people have a good time. Mm. In fact, one of my shows early on, Stu, when you were just a whippersnapper, the only show in Edinburgh that I actually gave a name to in the 90s was called Funny Isn't Good Enough.
Okay.
Because in those days, you kind of came to Edinburgh with an expectation that you might get a nod for an award.
Okay.
And I realised then that funny just wasn't good enough. You had to have an angle, a slant, or,
sure,
or something else going for you.
Okay.
That wasn't my shtick.
Okay. And so the show Funny Wasn't Good Enough was about the fact you didn't have an angle? Or it wasn't about anything? It was just jokes?
Just a name.
Okay.
as of this year's. It's just funny stuff.
And your show this year is called?
Legally Bald 2. Last year's show was called Legally Bald, after the film Legally Blonde. So I know that the sequel to that was Legally Blonde 2.
Yeah.
And I think there's been a third one.
Let's hope so.
Does any maybe you guys know, is there a third Legally Blonde?
No.
All right. Better get your thinking cap on for next year's title.
I wish I'd called last year's show Rocky.
I imagine, and I may be wrong, I imagine that one of the ways in which you're most familiar to audiences, and possibly people here as well, is through your radio show.
Indeed.
And which you're on BBC Scotland.
Yeah.
And you're on, I've only ever done it on a Friday. Are you on every day?
We're on every day. Okay. Stu, yeah. And it's a show that I've been doing for 15 years.
Okay.
And it was going to be a fairly short-term gig. Mm. They asked me if I would come and do the morning show.
Okay.
In 1997, and they said, Fred, people usually only do this for 2 or 3 years, but we want you to commit to doing it over the millennium. So we're looking for a 5-year stint.
Oh really? No, in all seriousness, they said, right, you've got to go over the line of the millennium.
Yeah. Okay. So they wanted just a bit of consistency, and the show is still going on, so 15 years done.
Yeah.
And part of the reason that I did that was because I'd had 5 years doing the London circuit, and was getting a bit, not tired, but I mean it was not a nor treadmill, because it was the most exciting period of my life,
sure,
creatively and in comedy. But the kids were wee at the time, and it gave me an opportunity to kind of stop being on the road so much. So
okay.
Grasped it with both hands, and as I've discovered, I've been able to kind of have this dual lifestyle, with the radio show in the morning and then still to continue to do other things.
Yeah,
as well.
Well, let's talk for a bit then about those 5 years on the circuit.
All
before
right.
The radio. So that was, you were based in London?
Well, I was still based in Glasgow. The family home was in Glasgow.
Okay.
That's where Aileen and the kids were. But I had to rent accommodation in London.
Mm-hmm.
That was 2 or 3 flats, just as I kind of
should
have that as a base, so that I didn't have to find someplace different every time.
Yes, okay.
So, but I would be in London maybe 15, sometimes 20 nights a month, just working in the stand-up circuit.
And who are your contemporaries, just so we can sort of place you on the circuit?
Well, in those days, Eddie Izzard, Sean Hughes was doing a lot of gigs, Phil Jupiter's. Phil and I did an awful lot of work together in those days. Coogan was there,
mm-hmm.
Lee Evans, you know, Joe Brand. I mean,
okay.
that wasn't an untypical lineup at the Comedy Store. And the MCs in those days were myself, Bob Mills,
oh, yeah.
Lee
yeah.
Hurst,
okay.
Tim Clark as mm-hmm. well, and you know, some people have gone on to do other things, others are still working away in the circuit, you know.
Sure. And so you were predominantly a comp pair, or were you doing sets or what?
I started off doing sets, and you know, you know the way it worked. Well, maybe you guys don't, the people listening. You would go in and you get a nice slot, you know, you get a gentle slot that's specifically there for twinklers. And you do that, and then you move up. Eventually, you would headline, and then after headlining, I always wanted to MC, You know, people that I knew that had emceed seemed to have moved on in their careers. So for me, it was a target. You know, Ben Elton had been MC at the Comedy Store,
sure.
The Comic Strip. I thought, if I can MC the Comedy Store, and I knew that there hadn't been any other Scots had MC'd the Comedy Store. So that was an aim, that was an ambition for me. Get to that level and then use that to...
That's quite interesting for someone like me, currently on the circuit in Britain and a lot of the time in London, to hear that MCing was a goal. I think MCing these days is sometimes seen as a bit of a trap, that if you end up MCing, then that's all they'll ever book you for, because people need a safe pair of hands. So once you MC, you then can't get out of it and
fully understand that. There was another thing I did as well, Stu, at that time, which was very, very similar in that respect, which was studio warm-up. Audience warm-up for TV studios. Yeah. And I was the warm-up man for Have I Got News For You for over 2 years. I did nearly five series. But I had a very specific aim, which was do it and then stop doing it. And that's a lucrative employment.
Sure. And very difficult to walk away from. Very difficult to actually go, okay, I'm gonna take less than this. Because a warm-up gig can often pay, I don't know if it was the same then, but maybe three times as much as a normal 20.
Absolutely. So I would do that, and it's very tempting, you know, to have that kind of regular income with a wife and three small children at home. Mm-hmm. But again, same as MCing, it was a target, it was something I wanted to do, and I gave it a very specific period of time and then moved on.
Sure.
And the phone would ring, you know, and people would say, oh, I've got this, you know, new show, we want you to come down, you're a great warm-up man, come and do that. Mm-hmm. And I would have to say no. Okay, we move on.
And did you find that hard, or was it just you seemed quite driven? You had goals and
I did. Certainly in those days, I had a lot of ambitions. You know, there were certain things that I really wanted to do, and boxes to tick in my career. You know, things like we can talk about them just now. But I always, as soon as I got into comedy and entertainment, I wanted to be the man that hosted BBC Scotland's Hogmanay show.
Okay.
I don't know why, but I just thought that was going to be, you know, another thing to aim to do, and I did that as well for a couple of years.
So really good fun interviewing Fred. You might be able... Oh, a couple of things, actually. First thing, I should apologise for the noise of the fan in the background. I think this is the only recording where that happens. I think there might be one coming up where it fanned for a bit and then we remembered and our venue tech, Neil, snuck up and turned it off 5 minutes in. But I think it persists throughout the recording. I could try and get rid of it, but I think it sort of knackers the rest of the quality. I hope it's listenable. Quick apology as well. As you can probably hear, I'm a little bit untogether in this interview. It's only the second live one I did. The first one I did was, of course, with Sarah Pascoe, who talks 10 to the dozen and is a sort of buddy of mine that I've known for a long time. Fred, I think I have to say I was slightly nervous in front of, because he's interviewed me several times on his radio show and on BBC Radio, and I've been on his shows at Edinburgh as well. And I think I was just a little bit cowed. I was a little bit sort of nervous to be interviewing him. I think as the interview goes on, I relax a little bit. And I think we also start to get a little bit more of the nitty gritty out of him as to how he makes his material. I think it's fascinating, actually. Sort of, I realised halfway through that Fred was sneakily trying out loads of new stuff on the audience of the podcast. But I think that's a valid thing to keep in. I think it's really interesting that's predominantly his writing process is to go from notes to just trying things out conversationally. And I think that would be true of a lot of compares. Very interesting to hear Fred's thoughts on comparing. He's an anecdotal kind of a guy, and there's some lovely stories in here as well. And that's really all I'm going to say for now. We'll get straight back into this in a second. One thing is just to plug Fred's tour. He's still currently on tour. You can go to his website, fredmacaulay.com, and that's Fred, M-A-C-A-U-L-A-Y. Fred McCauley.com for details of the tour. I understand it's been going very well so far. Go and see him if you can. Dates are on the website. And also I'm starting a Tumblr blog. I don't even know what it is, but I'm starting one. It should be fun. Just a means for me to put more stuff up on the website. So do check out comedianscomedian.com. There's bits and bobs there. I'll put up quotes and pictures and stuff from the interviews. Do check that out, even if you're listening on iTunes. Also, there is a new hack page now. It's up and running. comedianscomedian.com/new hack. You can submit your own examples of hack that you've heard on the circuit, such as just things that you've heard done to death. Boom, buckle up. Kai Humphreys got in touch with me by text, actually. I'll put this up manually to point out that unicorns are also new hack. Unicorns are a kind of a go-to surreal thing. So anything you find that you're sick to death of hearing of, submit it at new hack.
which is comedianscomedian.com/newhack. There's some other bits and bobs, but I'll be honest, I'm having quite a tough week. So let's get straight back onto the interview, and do me that one last favour as well. Of course, the podcast remains free. I don't have any sponsorship. It doesn't make me any money. So all I'm asking from you is that you find someone who you think would like it and convince them to listen to it. Just give them a spiel. Give them your money lines. Give them 2 minutes worth of you've really got to listen to this thing and see if we can grow it a little bit. That would be really good fun. Thank you all for listening. And back to Fred.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
So, in terms of your work as a stand-up, when you were hosting, were you writing jokes when you were emceeing? Did you have a similarly driven approach to the production of material in those years on the circuit?
Because even though I would be emceeing places like The Store and Jonglers, and in those days, Jonglers had two venues, one in Clapham and one up at Camden. But even though I was emceeing there, I would still be doing sets, and longer sets, and extended sets, and then coming to Edinburgh as well. So for Edinburgh, you were needing an hour-long show. So when you're emceeing, and that, for me, provided me with a perfect route to try out material, because if you're on stage, you do the chatting with the audience kind of stuff, and then you've got the good material that you know is going to work, win them over, and then you can slip in stuff, and you're on 4 or 5 times, so you get that opportunity to try new material, little bits, almost just one-liners or bits that you think might work up into a routine.
Sure. So let's talk about the journey of an idea from the first time you have the idea and maybe you make a note of it. And I mean, if we can, I don't know, have you noticed a difference in how you worked then to how you work now in the preparation of this show? Because we can maybe talk about that a little bit later on if there's a difference.
Yeah.
But looking at that time on the circuit, I know a lot of people, the listenership of this show, the podcast show, is newer comedians. A lot of open spots are really excited about it. And
hello,
wanting to...
Hello, young'uns.
Hello, young'uns. Look how many of you there are.
Well, absolutely. That is one thing that has really changed. But, the process has changed a wee bit. We've kind of gone electronic. Although we did have computers in those days.
But not ones you could put in your pocket. So let's look then at those years in London. You have an idea, and I mean, I don't know if you can think of a particular bit of material that was like a mainstay at that time. I'm not going to ask you to perform it.
No. It is pretty much the same. In those days, it would have been just, I never had a notebook. Mm-hmm. It was always scraps of paper, always A4 bits of paper, and they would be written, ideas would be written down. And I would pretty much have them in my head. Doing a lot of traveling, I did a lot of thinking and doing things over in my mind. Mm-hmm. And then if I thought it was good, I would just jot down a few words.
Okay.
So it was scribbles. Okay. But not in a notebook. I'm a loose leaf man.
It strikes me, it's funny, a lot of the different comedians I talk to have got very different takes on how they would write it, very different sort of systems. And a lot of people say, because there's so much travel involved in stand-up comedy, this is the best opportunity to get the stuff done. I listen to a lot of podcasts now because there's a lot of podcasts available. And I do worry sometimes that I'm using up time that could be better spent looking out of the window creatively. if you see what I mean. Do you know what I mean? Because like even this show as well, I know there's a lot of other similar shows to this. I listen to that, I feel like I'm kind of working and learning about comedy. But at the same time, there seems to be less time these days available to sit and wonder.
No, you're absolutely right. And I admire, and there are folks, there are so many different ways that people go about the task of creating new material. Some will just do it on stage and improvise, won't they? And then others have, I've noticed people tweeting, oh, today's a writing day.
Yeah.
You know, so they'll go and they'll write and they'll hack stuff out in the computer. Now, I brought my laptop with me today and thankfully, it's run out of power because there's very little in it. I do sit down every now and again and try and batter stuff out, and I can say with an element of confidence that nothing I've ever done in those circumstances has made it successfully on the stage.
Really?
It's rubbish.
Okay, that's interesting. Something I was talking to Sarah about yesterday, Sarah Pascoe. She's a phenomenal diarist, and she seems to have recorded almost every aspect of her life. So she's got huge amounts of stuff to draw on, and she likes to sit and actually write. I think one of my strongest suits is in improvising on stage.
Yeah.
But I find sometimes I try and make myself sit down and write, and I do have a schedule of writing hours. And I noticed when you discussed, when you just mentioned, some people tweet that they're doing a writing day, and you looked a bit aghast at the very idea. I mean, I try and do those, but I do find that sometimes the writing can become very stagnant because you end up doing a lot of cutting and pasting, and you're writing on your laptop and going, okay, I'm trying to be creative now, I'm trying to bash something out, but really I'm just, it's the equivalent of pushing food around a plate rather than a much more spontaneous live kind of a moment.
Well, I've just produced my iPhone here, and on the notes section, okay?
Okay, yeah, that's great.
Now, I need this because I'm doing a little bit of accountancy at the start of the shows, just to let people know about taxation issues that some comedians have got themselves into. So I'm being very upfront this year about my earnings at the Fringe. So there's quite a lot of that. Then I've got my set list from Falkirk, which I can go through tonight, and that's you can just see there. Sorry, this is very visual for a podcast.
That's quite all right.
These are just the sort of trigger words that I'm looking for. But also in this, there are bits where I've tried to write, right? And I, Stuart, I'm going to be honest with you. This is on a par with what was on the laptop.
Okay. Feel free. This can be. There's no need for this to be you showing off good writing. And in fact, to be more interesting.
Just to let you know more about Fred McCauley. The other notes that I've got here. I've got my Vodafone password. I've got the address of a theatre in Worcester that I was going to think about doing some stuff for. I've got my LA set. I've got my BBC password, my list of fringe comps, which I've got to say is rather more extensive than any of the material I've written.
This has suddenly become a very valuable object, and all eyes are upon it.
My bank login, right, this is for my bank account, and it's the same 8 numeric code that I have to key in every day to get into the number of bank accounts that I've got, and I occasionally forget it. But here is Legally Bald 2, and I've got a Tom Cruise, Katie Holmes gag in there that is not going to see the light of day, and it's certainly not going to be part of the podcast. There's a wee mention of 50 Shades of Grey. And then I have new bits, okay? And again, just as you, this is the kind of thing I would have written down on the wee scraps of paper. So
okay.
New bits, I've got 3D TV, I've got Connolly Heckles, MySpace and Bebo, selling DVDs, Donald Duck and Porky, getting jittery around Easter time, what would Jesus do? And then the Lord's Prayer at school. Now here's something, now you can see this is a wee bit longer, and that's the kind of stuff I would write on a computer. So I don't know if you, have you got edit facilities in this podcast? Or are we,
yes I have, yeah, absolutely. We don't on these humans.
Okay. This has never been said out loud before, okay? Is it all right to do
that? Yeah, of course, no, absolutely. This is exactly the point.
The Lord's Prayer at school, I don't know the words. It's the same with flight safety. We're here primarily for your safety, the stewardess says. And I've heard that probably 100 times a year. And I don't know what comes after the seatbelt bit. Something about the life vest and forgiving debtors as they forgive. And then the captain comes on to tell you why there's a delay, and you're always disappointed because recently it's become operational reasons. That's it. The least they could say is that somebody has messed up, or somebody's really messed up. Apologies for the delay, but one of the baggage handlers has messed up. He put the bags on a bus. I thought that was funny. Passengers on the starboard side can see the first officer giving him a doing. We could have left on time, but we had to teach the dozy a lesson. Operational reasons. Sorry if that joke doesn't work. It was because of operational reasons.
So that's
something that I hacked out, okay?
But yes, okay.
And it was kind of you to laugh. But for me, I don't know that that would work as stand-up.
Yeah, and do you think that's because that's something you sat down and written? When you say hacked out, you mean you sort of sat on a bus or something and written that to yourself?
Yeah.
And thought, and it made you laugh at the time?
It did.
I'm not asking you to sort of hack yourself and go, yes, I thought it was brilliant.
The good thing, Stu, is, as you know, we never discard anything, right? All the wee notes and things you keep, and there are lines that, you know, I might not have a use for any of that stuff just now, but something might come back from that.
So with that, just using that as an example for a moment, this idea of operational, I mean, we can sort of see where you're coming from with the joke.
Uh-huh.
I mean, to say, yeah, we can see what you're trying to do. That's not what I mean. But, you know, you've got this idea of operational reasons and never being given enough information, which seems like a very fecund topic to do something with. So did that start from you sitting on a plane? What was the first idea? Where did that first germinate from?
That was the plane, and it was the captain saying, oh, and the reason that we're late, and I was thinking, good, at last somebody's not taking the bland corporate route. He's going to tell us why we're late.
Sure.
And it's operational reasons. I think that just covers everything, doesn't it? And also, within a few days of that, I'd been at a train station. I live in a village that has got a train that runs into Glasgow, and not all the trains stop and pick us up.
Okay.
But one an hour does. Okay. And it's at 5 minutes past the hour. And I went down to get the train into town to go to a gig in Edinburgh. So needed the train into town, train through to Edinburgh. And at 10 past the hour, I realised something was wrong. And it's not a manned station, so there's a button that you press and it connects you with the sort of hub in Glasgow. And I said, hello, I'm waiting to get the 5 past train, there's no sign. He said, it's been cancelled. And I said, well, how was I and the other passengers meant to know that? I said, because I said, is there another one being laid on, or is there a bus service for the three of us? And he said, no, there should have been an announcement. And I said, well, there wasn't. And he said, well, there should have been. And I said, well, there wasn't.
Well,
and I said, how long is this going to go on? I said, because there was no announcement and you've just left us standing here. And he said, all I can say is there should have been an announcement. And I said, look, is that all you're going to say? I said, come on, man, we're human beings. And then he made something about, well, don't take that attitude. And I said, well, you know, just be honest with me. And he said, okay. He said, all I can say is there should have been an announcement. And this was just this corporate bland, they're frightened to say anything in case there's some kind of repercussion. Another train incident, right? And this might all, so now we've got that, operational reason.
Okay.
We've got the phone call. There was another train one that's just come to my mind. I was late getting the sleeper home from London back to Glasgow to do my radio show, right? And it's due to get into Glasgow at 7 a.m. I'm not on air until 10:30, so I've got 3.5 hours to play with. We're 4 hours late, right? And we're sitting south of Carstairs. And I said to the train manager, I said, listen, I know you know who I am. I've got a radio show to do. It's pretty vital that I'm there. I said, how long before we get to Carstairs and I'll get somebody to pick me up from there and get me up? And I said, how long till we get to Carstairs? And we were stationary at the time. And he said, I'd like to say 10 minutes. I said, that's meaningless. Unless we're going to be there in 10 minutes. I said, that is meaningless. I said, when will be? He said, I'd like to say 10 minutes. I said, and same again.
Yeah.
You know, I'm of an age where you can kind of say, oh, come on. I said, will we be there in 10 minutes? He said, no. What's the point in saying, I'd like to say 10 minutes? I'd like to say, you know, lots of things.
Sure.
But it's meaningless.
So now, having just related that anecdote now, is that something you've used on stage previously?
I used that Once, I think. In fact, the train manager thing I've never used.
Okay.
The phone call thing I did once.
Sure.
There should have been an announcement.
Mm-hmm.
And he went. He said, "Okay, hang on, I'll just check." And I don't know what he did to go and check. He came back and I said, "Have you checked?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "So what's the story?" He said, "There should have been an announcement."
So maybe now
we've got something, a sort of George Carlin, things that annoy me, you know.
Okay,
condensed.
That's
things.
It. It's kind of forming into a routine and creating around the idea of frustration at specifically that, you know, a corporation, bigger organisations not taking responsibility.
Because I spend 5 days a week interviewing people's students, forgive me.
Yeah, no, not at all, you're not
on it. But just before I go on to the other page, Goal Line Technology, we're speaking on the 4th of August. The Scottish football season starts today, and we don't have it up here, but down south, I gather, you're having Goal Line Technology.
We talked about this actually.
Did you?
You and I did on your comedy show. That was one of the subjects.
Uh-huh.
With me and Ollie Mann. And I remember saying, "Oh, this means that Ollie Mann must be really seriously not into sport, if I've been given a football question about which I know nothing."
I've just said, can we backdate it maybe to July 1966? That's all right, isn't it? That's all right. So that there you are. That's new bits.
Sure. So the things you've said to us now, the last couple of stories you've told us, those sort of examples, they're almost very fully formed routines, aren't they?
Yes.
So given that you know that the end part of that routine is going to be funny, you know the punchline of that story, uh-huh. You know where the guy's saying, you know, if he's gone back and checked and then come back and said, "I'd like to say it," is it going to be no? We can recognise that. And presumably, when that event either happens or when you sit and write that down, you can look at that with some degree of certainty and go, "That'll make them laugh."
Yeah.
That'll work.
That's right.
And then what else do you do? What's the next step for that story? Is it just that you get on stage and tell it and find yourself naturally embellishing it? Or do you ruminate on embellishments you can make, or do you put it on paper? What's the next step?
Well, I don't know how many people you've talked about this, but once you do it on stage, and if you get the generosity of a laugh, that gives you a split second and you might be able to improvise something about it. And that is how a routine would develop.
Yes.
Okay? And that was where, you know, back at the Comedy Store, emceeing these, maybe, you know, in amongst all the other bits and pieces that I would do, I would batter in a new bit, right?
Okay.
And then it might develop. And what I did in those days too was I would work lines and bits, and then I used to maybe try them out only once or twice, and then put them away.
Okay.
And then bring them all out for Edinburgh. So a new hour for Edinburgh.
And so that hour would be fresh.
That's
so
right.
Oh, I see. So you wouldn't spend the year working those things up in order to take them to Edinburgh. Because that's very much the model that what I subscribe to now, and I think a lot of people do, I've spoken about this before on the show, is about how one ends up spending one's life doing not as well as one could be doing in a club in order to get stuff ready. Uh-huh. Like on a Saturday night in Deptford, uh-huh. I'll be thinking I could bring out the big guns here and make sure I get rebooked and all the rest of it. But there really is that five that I'm thinking about for Edinburgh that by the time I get to Edinburgh has got to really have been run in and improvised around.
That was a different look at Edinburgh, and you know, as I say, the luxury of being able to do preview shows. And I think preview shows for Edinburgh is something that's come along in the last 10 years or so.
Yes.
I don't think when I first started, and it was 93 I did my first full one-man show here.
Okay.
I don't think people did that. I think once you got to Edinburgh, there'd be a sort of bedding in 5 or 6 nights. And
yes.
I would reckon that by sort of Tuesday or Wednesday next week, I wouldn't want to have any notes on stage with me.
Okay.
I'll have it off pat by then. This is the next stage in the progress.
Okay.
You can tell the ex-accountant in me, buff folder, fringe 2012. And then inside this, and you know, just so you know, folks, there are very few people have seen inside this folder. Last night's audience obviously saw it all. And it fell open like that, and I could see people trying to read what's on the inside cover. These are the comps, these are the freeloaders, okay? These are the ones that say, "Oh Fred, there's 6 of us coming through, can we come and see your show?" And then the scraps of paper, there you are, there's a scrap of paper, and that's, this isn't one of the quartered ones, this has just been folded over like that, and then you get various degrees of bad handwriting. We can't see the first one out loud.
No,
there's two swear words.
I saw you do that joke on your website. There's a clip of you doing that joke.
That's which is about the States.
Farming implements.
That's right.
Yeah, there's certain swear words popular in Scotland sounding like farming implements.
If you think of some long swear words.
Yeah.
And that's a bit that really worked out in the States. The people really love that.
They love that, absolutely.
Then Amish, drunk guy at the airport, and then my wife's obviously been looking for a scrap of paper and she's written down Johnson Carmichael, and that's not a routine. Somebody that she needed to phone or took a message from. There's something about my DNA underneath.
It might be Johnson Carmichael might be the beginnings of a routine if you were to explain that, you know, this was on my notes one time and now I've got to do a gag about someone called Johnson Carmichael. I've no idea.
Imagine if somebody listening said, that's me.
What's Fred's wife doing, making notes about me?
I was in London this week, down at the Olympics, went for a meal. I went to an Ethiopian restaurant, and I couldn't believe it. I had a dish called Derek Tibbs. I couldn't go past that. You know, people were having hummus, you know, chicken skewers and kebabs and things like that. I couldn't get past that. I'm going to have Derek Tibbs. Balotelli, that's a joke that is neither relevant, because we're, you know, in Edinburgh. But Guy in Pants, that I wrote, this was in the folder.
Talk us through Guy in Pants.
Guy in Pants was a man that I saw. I was down doing the news quiz, and I've got a routine just about a drunk Scot waiting to get on to a flight at East Midlands Airport, which is, you know, just based on observation of a man who's clearly drunk, hoping to get the last flight home to Glasgow. And I just, I knew he was Scottish, you know, I knew he was Scottish, and I didn't know why I knew, whether it was his dress, or his baggage, or the drunken state that he was in. Got in there, so I was doing news quiz, and I was staying in the Holiday Inn Regent's Park, which sounds lovely, and it's not. And I went in, and it was about 12:45, and there was a man standing in his pants at the front reception desk, right? That's all he had on, was a pair of briefs, and I was probably, I don't know, maybe 50 feet away, and I said, and I looked over and I thought, that man's Scottish. and I had no idea why, and I had no reason to go over to the reception area. I had a key, I was fully clothed. I could just have gone straight to my room. I walked over just to hear him, and he's going, oh, I'm locked out my room, darling. I'm going, I don't know what you're doing. Right? And he was Scottish, and I went over, and I got in the lift, and he goes, hold the lift! And he came up, and he got in, and very, very drunk. And then I said, locked out your room? Aye. I said, how did that happen? Party. So there clearly was a party going on someplace, and it was you didn't obviously need a lot of dress to be in, but he'd come out of the party and forgot where his room was, and then went out and asked reception for a key for his room. So that's Guy in Pants. So I mean, it's not a routine, it's not something I've written, but it's sure to be sort of anecdotes, and I do that kind of stuff. And,
yes, Do you find that you ever write one-liners as well? Are you purely an anecdotalist? Do you gather? I mean, I sit occasionally and try to write one-liners. I find it incredibly difficult. It's such a skill, and I'm much more of a kind of storyteller.
Yeah.
But every time I've sat down and written one, maybe of the 10 times I'll sit down and try to write one-liners, I'll get two good gags out.
Yeah.
And they're really useful for having in your back pocket to sprinkle in the middle of a routine if you feel that you've lost them or something. You know. Something's, yeah. Out of the way. Do you ever do that? Do you have those sort of things?
Yeah. I mean, not for my own stuff. And three times I've done Mock the Week, and you know the bit at the end where you're kind of standing on the steps and you've got to get into the microphone. They give you things to write about.
Sure.
And you've got to come up with the goods for that. So, and having done Have I Got News for You and things like that, Mock the Week is very, very different. I mean, you're getting drip-fed stuff from about the Monday for a Wednesday or a Thursday recording.
Okay.
So you're writing all the time. And what I did learn from that was, you know, it's like if you sit down, you know, and they say, right, we need five lines on such and such.
Yes.
And you kind of write five, and you think, well, the first two are good.
Yes.
And then it kind of dribbles.
Yeah. The rest is up to all
that. Is that going back and revisiting it.
Okay.
And actually sweating it out, you can't come up with more.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there is something in there, but nowhere like the output of Frankie, you know, who is an incredible one-liner and joke merchant. I mean, the guy's so prolific. But I mean, over the years I've come up with some one-liners. One that I love, you know, here's one that I love the English language. I love having studied Latin, the way that words are formed, either from Latin or Greek words. But you know that the word mosaic is actually just made up of tiny wee bits of other words.
Very nice. When did you write that?
Was that a long time ago.
Okay.
And it was one that, again, is lovely for this situation here. We're just having a chat about writing comedy. It's not something that we'd ever think, oh, that's going in my stand-up set, because that'll blow the roof off the place. Yeah. It's a gentle new line.
Sure. But in the writing of it, was that something that just occurred to you and you went, oh, that'll work as a joke, rather than something you kind of did a spider diagram around the concept of language or something?
No, that you're right. That was something that just I thought about. But the actual process of writing one-liners, I would say, not just for Mock the Week, but a lot of radio shows in the past as well.
Yes.
I used to do a thing on Five Live donkeys years ago, a long, long time ago, called Hold the Front Page.
Okay.
And that was, I think we did about five series of that, and that was a lot of one-liners.
And what was your system for writing those? If they give you a subject, that's obviously a lot easier, because otherwise, it's that blank page tyranny, isn't it? Yeah. You have no idea what would
happen if Lord Nelson had walked down Carnaby Street in the 60s.
Okay. Oh, so they give you, they're giving you sort of almost both halves, they're giving you two concepts, saying smash these together, and find links between them.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting. I thought it would be more like just a kind of subject to begin with, but I suppose that's true of the ones that I've been given by your production team for the radio show.
Yeah.
Is, you do get a subject, and as I did with the football, I go, Jesus, I'm up the night before going, what can I say about football? I've literally no idea. I don't remember the goal line technology. The abbreviation is GLT. And I think my opening gag was to do with how I thought I knew so little about sport, I thought that was a sandwich. You're being very kind. But you know what I mean? You just try and chuck out as many as possible and then try them on someone. That's certainly part of my process. Yeah. Do you find that the Aileen becomes a sounding board for
yourself? Aileen is great. And I mean, you think this is a long stint for me. I enjoy performing. Aileen will be at every gig. And she writes stuff down for me as well.
Okay.
And she knows the shows well enough that she can recognise an ad lib and something that's going to be added in.
And she'll make a note of it, so you remember it for next time. That's fabulous.
An older ex-accountant, now comedian, Scott, is Arnold Brown. Arnold certainly, in his heyday, used to record every gig he did on tape and listen back to it. Because you forget the throwaways.
Absolutely.
And sometimes they can be brought back into
I find it so hard when this has come up in the show before, is the discipline to actually listen back to a gig that you've recorded. Particularly if it's a preview and it's an hour long. And you're thinking there'll be relatively few nuggets in there. And if it went really well, you think, hey, I'll just remember that stuff because it was great. And if it went really badly, you think, I can't make myself sit through that experience again. Although often you do find the opposite happens. If you've got a great one and you listen back to it, you can very easily find yourself going, oh, it wasn't as good as I thought. And if it was dreadful, you listen back and go, no, to be fair, there were some laughs in there. So. Yeah, I think the issue is the ego is rampaging at the time.
It's funny, isn't it? Because, and again, we're having somebody like Aileen who comes to a lot of gigs. How many years have you been doing this, Stu?
Seven,
right. So this, for me, I'm way ahead of you in that respect. But you know the feeling sometimes when you're doing a gig, and I used to be guilty of not doing this. Sometimes you can just kind of paint on a smile and keep going. What I was guilty of in the past was letting my feelings show in my face and just think, oh, this is a terrible gig, and I can't wait for the next 58 minutes to go.
Yeah.
I've only been on two.
Yeah.
And, once I was doing the Backstage Stephen and Gilded Balloon, and it was a horrible, horrible gig. And I was almost on the stage at the point of saying, listen, let's just call it quits and go. And from the depths of the audience, I heard, come on, Fred. I thought, wow, that's amazing, right? This encouragement from Aileen, and I got it, and I won the audience over. And it was still one of the greatest gigs I ever did. And afterwards, I said, thank you so much for that. And she said, what? I said, I heard you saying, come on, Fred. She said, I didn't. Right? And where it came from, I don't know. Maybe I imagined it, or maybe it was somebody else. But she
benevolent.
It wasn't me. Or maybe she said it and just didn't realise she had.
Yeah. That's lovely. And I think sometimes that's all you would need, isn't it? To just know that something Sarah was talking about yesterday was the experience of looking at a room full of people and realising they're not up for you, they're not laughing. But sometimes that doesn't mean they're not enjoying it. They might be sitting there thinking, come on, Fred, yeah, or equivalent, you know, which would be frustrating during, I would like to be happy with, come on, Fred. Come on, Fred, no, this
what about
bad.
Bring on, Fred?
Yeah, yeah.
And here, I know we're gabbing, it's been a lovely chat, but and this is the quarter page. Okay.
So when I thought you were talking about in terms of quartering the hour, into 15-minute sections, but you actually physically...
I do actually physically quarter the page, and there you are. French 2012, Stand 3, Friday the 3rd. And we start off with swearing, and then the second quarter starts with the Scot at Leicester Airport or East Midlands. Then the third quarter starts with Big Question. That's about Scottish, that's the politics up there. And then the fourth quarter starts with 50 Shades of Grey.
Dirty stuff at the end.
Dirty stuff at the end. Yeah. Mobile phones, and then perspective. Perspective is a story just about something that happened 24 years ago.
Okay.
Just about in the early stages of our marriage.
Okay.
Married 28 years, folks.
But yeah, they're not fast.
We've been together for more than half of that.
So with it, you were talking about rejigging the order. Is that exactly what you mean by that? Do you find that have you identified that structure because the pieces work, the individual parts work rhythmically, there's a flow to them? Or is it that they are linked in terms of theme? And you know, once you've set this up, now we can talk about this. Which way around does that work?
At this stage, the whole thing might get rejigged, okay? Mm-hmm. But I will finish on perspective. How I start, I'm not altogether sure. And what I'll do today is just look at what we've got, maybe about 20 segments there, and just sort of move them about. I'm not sure whether, I mean, there's stuff about Billy Connolly, and that might move over into the Scottish bit as well, because Billy's somebody that is, you know,
sure.
We'll see whether he thinks that Scotland should have independence or not.
The rest
is just scraps, that's all the scraps.
Do you, within an hour, do you identify like something that, I don't know if this is sort of common knowledge, but amongst comedians there's this idea that 40 minutes into an hour there's a bit of a lull.
Uh-huh.
And then, because an hour is a long time, as you're aware, we've just passed it. we're significantly past it, it's all right. But at the 40-minute mark, there tends to be a bit of a lull where people kind of go, oh, I've been sitting still for quite a while. And I know something that Mark Watson has done, many of you know the fabulous comedian Mark Watson. I supported him on tour for a couple of years and saw his shows many, many times. And he would do a lovely thing in one of them where he would nominate someone at the beginning of the show and say, 40 minutes in, there'll be a lull. So can you just start shouting lull, lull at the 40-minute mark to try and cover it, which is a funny idea, and also has a chance for everyone to refresh and go, right, this is as far as we are. And I'm just thinking in terms of those kind of moments of rhythm. You presumably, after the amount of time you've been doing this, you have an instinct for the shape of a show.
Yeah.
So the decisions you're making might be informed by, with the Billy Connolly stuff, does that... I think what I'm getting at is there's lots of different reasons you could move it. Mm-hmm. You could move it by reasons of theme. You could move it because it's a bit bluer and you want it later on. Or you might be moving it because you're thinking, well, do you know this? I mean, this punchline is a cracker, and it will save me if the bit before that is a little bit weaker. Are you making those sort of decisions? Are those going into it?
Yes, I am, definitely. And you're absolutely right. There is a rhythm to the show, and I always want to absolutely open really strongly. And something that, and then close with a big one as well. And you're right. You maybe have some bankers that you move around.
Yes.
Just to kind of bring the level of, the energy back up. And that goes all the way back to emceeing and warm up. You know.
Yeah.
Especially warm ups where you were on and off throughout the night, and sometimes maybe a sketch didn't work, or a scene in a sitcom didn't go as well as the director had hoped. You go back on and you've kind of got to get the audience back up. So I know all about that, and it's something that, you know, all across entertainment you'll get, in television and in films as well. You know, the 20-minute, something significant has got to occur at the 20-minute point in a movie.
Yes,
a big shift in direction, perhaps. But I will do that. I will jig things around. Mm-hmm. But I always was guilty, if I wrote something new, I always wanted to get it in early.
Yes, classic.
Yeah. Yeah. No matter how good it was and whether you thought it would be a good closing gag, I would just put it out, yeah. You know, and try and...
There's a tremendous danger sometimes of like having a great idea for a joke on the way to a gig and thinking, oh, brilliant, I'll open with this because yeah. I love it. And of course, you've never tried it before, and the first thing you say on stage is pretty crucial in stand-up. You've got to win people over.
So that was why, you know, with the emceeing, I managed to resist that urge and then just kind of filter it in.
Do you ever suffer from nerves? Did you ever suffer from nerves?
Oh, I mean, always. I mean, you do get, you get used to rooms, you get used to the facilities that are around you, you know, you get to know whether a room has got a good atmosphere and a good vibe, you know.
Sure.
What I mean? And in comedy club terms, I mean, we've got the stands here in Glasgow and Edinburgh, great rooms, you know, wonderful rooms, and the comedy store was always good, but no, I always did get nervous. Now what I'm, you know, sort of corporate events, when you're doing stuff to 1,500 suits, you know, and that used to faze me, and I think the nerves are simply down to fear of failure.
Okay.
Which exists, I think.
And how do you deal with that? Do you have any particular way of addressing that, or is it just not something that... Well, I mean, the nerves, not the time.
The one thing, you know, a big sort of after-dinner kind of cabaret spot or an award ceremony, and I do a lot of those presentations, I always look at my watch, you know, at sort of 9:45, and look at the watch and I think, well, at 11:45, this is all going to be over one way or another. Time's not going to stop, so let's just crack on.
I think it's worth just exploring, briefly describing what that scenario is. Often, and I've done similar of these, I'm sure, at a different level, but you will get booked to do some stand-up comedy or maybe to present an award in your role as a comedian to a bunch of people who have no interest in you being there. All they want to do, it's the end of the year, they just want to get smashed and try and get off with Tracy from accounts, or, you know, or whatever.
She's
level
a busy girl.
She is busy. So you can really feel like, this isn't what they want. I've been booked to be here and I've said yes to the money, but this isn't necessarily the most appropriate thing to happen now. You're not in control of any of the variables. They might be paying quite well, so you sort of think, I really have to. I've got to live up to this. Yeah.
But no, I would rather. I mean, people, you know, because of the radio thing, people say, "Oh, broadcaster Fred McCauley," and obviously, look at that. I still like to think of myself as comedian first and foremost.
Yes.
And I would, you know, I would far rather be out touring and maybe doing 5 or 6 theatre gigs a week.
Sure.
But sure. Just that's not the way it's worked out for us as a family.
Sure. Alfie Moore, who's a fabulous comedian who used to be a policeman until very recently, so 36 or something years on the force. It might be 26, I might be making older than he is. But Alfie was saying when he does after-dinner speaking, he always builds himself as an after-dinner speaker rather than a comedian, because then he gets to be the funniest after-dinner speaker. Do you see what I mean? It's quite a useful tip. Another comedian, Alan Cochrane, once gave me a similar tip for warm-up when I was starting doing studio warm-up, which is that if you walk on with a clipboard, you seem like a really funny member of the production staff, rather than if you walk on in a shiny suit and you know what I mean? You seem like, ta-da, it's going to be jokes now, and then actually it can be quite difficult to find the level of the thing.
I'm going to buy myself a pair of dungarees.
I'm just painting. Do you read your reviews, Fred?
Yes.
You do. Yeah. Are you comfortable with that? I don't know when the last time was that you got a negative review, but were you able to cope with it?
I got one last year that was 3 stars, and I think, you know, given the night that it was, I thought it was fair.
That's good.
You know, the blow was cushioned by a number of 4-star reviews quitting at the back of that.
Sure.
But I thought it was fair. I've never really found fault. You know, I've never had a stinker. But you know, they can come along.
I think sometimes, and you're saying 3 stars as well. Like, again, that might not be sort of common knowledge, but from a comedian's point of view, I think 3 stars is almost worse than 2 or 1, because if it's 2 or 1, at least they hated it. At least they had the reaction. Whereas 3 stars is sort of like someone going, yeah. You know, which can be, that can be quite upsetting.
But then, and I've never had a 5-star review, so I mean, 4 is as good as I'm aiming for. So fine.
That's quite nice. You calibrated yourself.
Yeah.
You're just aiming for...
I'm like somebody going into the Olympics thinking, yeah, I want a bronze.
Bronze is great. Yeah. We were discussing before the difference between bronze and last is a matter of microns sometimes, isn't it? It's perfectly easy. If there's any questions from the audience, we can field a few of them, if there are. If everyone is content.
There's a lady down there. Hello.
Hello. What keeps you driven?
What keeps me driven? Well, I said at the start, I used to have a lot of ambitions and, you know, boxes to tick. I'm a family man. My kids are now all in their 20s. So I'm at the stage now where I have the luxury of maybe readdressing some ambitions, you know, and maybe setting some things out on the horizon. But professionally, they're not quite so important. I would say they're more personal now. I've got a good Scottish Presbyterian work ethic. I work an awful lot. My missus would love it if I kind of took my foot off the gas a wee bit. I love working and I love what I do. I mean, I don't know if you know, but I mean, I was an accountant for a retail group and company secretary, and I had a good job. And then in my early 30s, I just thought there's more to life than this. So I'm, you know, and all the way down the line, I'm 55 now. I've always thought I am one of the few people that is doing exactly what they want to do with their life, you know? And there's millions of people out there who maybe think I'd rather be doing something else. And that drives me on, that I'm really fortunate. And I get to play golf and ski. Yeah.
You know,
I'm a happy man, aye. Yeah, I'm 14 handicap, I could do better, you know.
So it's always more boxes
yeah,
to tick.
There's an ambition, yeah, single handicap. I've come down from 22, down to 14, a really good medal round in May. Am I going on too much?
No, not at all. This is a lovely place to end the podcast on the idea of being happy. And I thought what we could do is I'll just gradually, when in the edit, I'll just turn the volume down slowly as Fred discusses his handicap.
This is where I differ from an awful lot of the stand-ups, you know, because people are looking at Donald Trump having built this golf course up in the east of Scotland, and they're saying, what has he done to the flora and the fauna there? And these were the most beautiful natural dunes, and I'm thinking, I wonder if we could hit the green with a 3-wood.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm happy to take another question. We may have time for one more if there is one. If not, then would you please join me in thanking Mr. Fred McCauley. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank
you. So that was Fred McCauley. Our next episode is coming up soon. I've not recorded it yet. I don't know who it's with. I've got a couple of possibles, all of whom are very exciting, but also I need to sort of try and fit them into my day-to-day life somehow as well. So who knows who's next? The next live one will be in 2 weeks, and that is with Josh Widdicombe. And I think it's safe to say it's one of the best ones we've ever done. I'm really excited about that one. So there we go. So thanks to To Entertain, as ever. Thank you, as always, to Tom Wateracre and to Graham Crockford for their technical support and assistance. Thanks to Toby Rose, who's my web guy. If you like the website, do give him a shout. He's got a link on there as well. And that'll do for now. Thanks to Fred. Do go to his website, fredmccauley.com, in order to get hold of some tickets for his current tour. And we'll be back very soon.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.